Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at it, how ideas move from being unthinkable to plausible to policy, and speak with the people who change what is possible in politics. Now, Richard Vedder doesn't pick easy battles, and you can tell by the name of his latest book, Let Colleges Fail, that he's picked a tough subject. Richard, welcome.
Well, glad to be with you, James.
It's rare to see colleges close. Why is that?
Why do colleges not close for it? Why do they stay open all the time? It's a good question, because a lot of colleges aren't doing terribly well these days by a lot of standard indicators of that. Well, they receive a lot of subsidies and support from outsiders, not the customers, the students for the most part, and occasionally research grants and so forth. But as say a typical liberal arts college, the main source of revenue is the students and their tuition fees. But that doesn't begin to cover the costs. So we have to find, they need to find money somewhere else. Private donations, a lot of it comes from federal and state subsidies of one sort or other. The federal government subsidies come in a sort of indirect form, a lot of it, in the form of student loans to students. So the colleges have, over the last 40, 50 years, raised their fees a lot more than they otherwise would have. Because, well, there's a government out there. You can just go borrow the money from the feds so we can jack up the fees a little bit. So they've done that, the colleges. So fees are pretty high. And so there's an indirect subsidy from the government that way. Plus, there's a lot of Pell Grants, which are not loans, but actual grants to students. And private philanthropy plays a role, too, I have to admit. So every college in the United States, practically, with one Michigan exception, Hillsdale, that comes to mind, are dependent on the federal government in one way or the other for part of their subsistence. And that has caused some problems. So the whole process has been politicized, and the subsidies have prevented colleges from doing maybe needed reforms that they otherwise would have done, but, well, we don't need to do them because the feds are paying for things.
Yeah. One of the things that a colleague who worked in higher education had noted is that colleges feel like they have lots of competition. There are lots and lots of state universities. When students are applying for places, they're usually not just applying to one college. And all of these institutions are trying to figure out, how can we outcompete for students? And what they found is that it's not by providing high quality, low-cost education. These students are going based on something else. And what a lot of these schools have found is, like, even if they're not winning these competitions, they're not really under a lot of threats to close. Because for at least the longest time anyway, you have more and more students, which means that, you know, you can add students even if some schools are adding them faster.
Yeah, and you are located in an area where this is particularly interesting and true. The Midwest, and I'll use Michigan as an example, has had a large number of state colleges and universities that have had enormous enrollment decline over the last 15 years, that without those subsidies, they would have closed. My mother was a graduate of Eastern Michigan University, for example. And it's
when they were the Hurons, not the Eagles.
Yeah. And they've fallen, 40%, 50%. One of my best friends and former students has an endowed chair at Central Michigan University. Similar pattern, a big enrollment decline, 40-50% over a decade or so. Yet they still subsist and exist through various subsidies and so forth. And so in the private sector, usually markets work, and people who aren't doing terribly well or providing a product that a lot of people have stopped liking, those businesses go out of business. I mean, what, you know, where is Sears and Roebuck these days? Where is JCPenney? They're shadows of their former selves. U.S. Steel. Where are these companies? They're mostly dead or dying or very, very small now compared with what they were 50 years ago. But you don't see much of that in higher ed, do you? And maybe that's a shame, because when there's a threat of failure, it's really a real threat. People innovate. They change. They find new ways to do things. They decide maybe we can keep the university open 12 months a year rather than 8 months a year, which is what we do now, or 9. Maybe here right now at the end of July, we could actually have students on campus. I'll bet if you go, even if you went to the University of Michigan, a very fine school, which has not had these enrollment problems. My father, by the way, graduated from there. You went to U of M in Ann Arbor, or you even went to Lansing, to Michigan State, Eastman Lansing. You have a different enrollment dynamic, but you still have a lot of inefficiencies. As I mentioned, buildings use 8 months a year, maybe not. I'm in an office right now with 32 offices on my floor. I walked around before we started this show, James. I was the only one in my office. One out of 32 offices occupied. What a waste of space. What inefficiencies. In the private sector, that just wouldn't be tolerated for very long.
So why does higher education in America need creative destruction?
Well, I'm hinting at it already. If we had the threat that these colleges would close, maybe someone would say, well, maybe we can become more efficient. Maybe we could offer a bachelor's degree in 3 years instead of four. That's what they do. There's this little school called Oxford University, pretty famous.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, pretty decent school. We people vie for scholarships called Rhodes Scholarships to go to Oxford every year. American students are dying to go to Oxford. How long do you spend at Oxford before you get a bachelor's degree? 3 years. Same all over the continent of Europe. Why not in the United States? You go to college. How much in a 12-month year are you actually in class? 7.5 months, about 30 weeks, 2 15-week semesters. 30 weeks is, as I say, is 7 months, really, is all it is. And yet we use up a 12-month period for that 7-month education. The other 5 months are other things, vacations. People have to go off in the summer to pick the crops. That's what we do in the summer, isn't it? All of us college students are all helping their fathers and mothers on the farm. That may have made some sense 200 years ago, 300 years ago. Doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense today. So there's a lot of traditions in higher ed that perhaps need to be challenged a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think if we had start having schools fail more often, a little bit more with greater regularity, I think we might see the higher education community becoming more responsive to these efficiency enhancing ideas that I just mentioned. A few of them, there are others that I haven't talked about, and maybe we could have a cheaper, more affordable education system. Students could get out of school maybe a year earlier and get out on the labor force where they're desperately needed. Another factor in that, James, is, and this has nothing, the colleges are not at fault for this, birth rates have plummeted all over the world, not just in the United States, all over the world. So we're facing an Armageddon. We're facing young people in America are going to be enormously burdened in the next generation or two. Someone has to take care of growing numbers of 80 and 90 year old people who need some help because they can't work. I'm in that group myself, by the way. You will see I am working. Some of us even still work because we're crazy and deranged, maybe. But we can modify our system, I think, to meet this challenge. In 1950, there were about six people of, let's call it, working age for every young person, or I mean every old person over 65. So we had six working age people for every old person, to sort of simplify it. By 2050, 100 years later, let me be about three. And from six to help pay for the old, now we will only have three. That's quite a burden. Our Social Security system is going bankrupt because of other federal irresponsible behavior. You people in Michigan do a lot of crazy things with your state government, but it's child's play compared with the goof on in D.C.
Well, budget requirements help out a lot, yeah.
I used to work for Congress, too. I plead guilty to part of this. I spent some time with a gang of 535 in Washington.
For listeners, check out that episode we did where he talks about his work in the Council for Economic Advisors.
So, anyway, so we have this, I think colleges are important. I think they're valuable. I think for the most part, they're good. But we have to change. I came on a statistic yesterday that I immediately wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, which they may or may not publish.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll
share. You're backed up with good content these days, which is a good problem to have.
So anyway, I'll share you. You are the first audience to hear this. It's nothing. It's just I came on it almost by accident. Let's look at the states in the union which have the most highest percentage of college educated adults. I mean, we're the largest percentage of adults are educated. The single state that is number one is
Massachusetts. Yes.
We're at 48% of people in Massachusetts have at least a bachelor's degree. Yeah.
But by the way, I want to say that's still less than half. And this is the most, like most people do not have a college degree. But anyway,
Massachusetts, 48%. What happened in the last year that we have statistics in terms of migration of people? I'm talking about native-born Americans. I'm not talking about immigrants. What happened? People left Massachusetts. More people moved out of Massachusetts than in. People were fleeing this highly educated state. What is the state of the union with the smallest percentage of college-educated people?
Ooh, I don't know.
West Virginia.
Okay, yeah.
24%, exactly, almost precisely half of the proportion in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Only 24% of the people in the state of West Virginia have at least a bachelor's degree. Some of them, of course, even have master's or PhDs or law degrees or MD degrees, so on. But less than a quarter, West Virginia had in migration. People were moving into West Virginia. Now, what does this say? It may be just coincidence, may have to say nothing, but I have a feeling that there's something about the environment of colleges that it is unattractive to a large percentage of the American people, and they just don't like what goes on in those highly educated states. Mm-hmm. People are too woke, too progressive, too contemptuous of traditional American values, and they feel uncomfortable in those states, and they moved. And also, they're in states where, because universities are very liberal, their faculty are progressive. They tend to be wokishly progressive and whatnot, they tend to have a very high percentage of have high taxes, for example, because to fund a lot of generous public policies, government programs, one kind, welfare benefits, one sort or other. They have ultra cool environmental laws, so that, you know, we're gonna keep the temperature on the planet Earth down by 1/100th of a degree centigrade by the year 2050, 2150, even if it means we have to double the price we pay for electricity, whatever. So these things are going on. So Californians who are ultra woke have an enormous out-migration right now of people. There are people fleeing California. They're fleeing New York. They're fleeing New Jersey. They're fleeing, and these are all very progressive left-of-center states, and they're moving to other states who tend to be more
fastest-growing states in the Union right now are Idaho and Utah.
Yeah, the states like Idaho and Utah, precisely. And people said, well, people are moving to Florida because the weather's so nice in Florida. Well, the weather's pretty much the same in California. California's drop-dead gorgeous.
It's nicer because you don't get that wet season.
Yeah, actually, California may be the night. Well, you know what state in the Union has one of the largest out-migration of population in relation, out-migration in relation to its basic population? Hawaii. Hawaii is losing people. Now, there's a talk about paradise, climatic paradise. Hawaii is hard to beat. It really is. South Dakota has in-migration of people. Now, no one moved. You know, do you want to move to South Dakota?
Because if I have a good-paying job, maybe.
And that's, you're on to a point there, James. And so what I'm saying is colleges are what economists sometimes call, college-educated people, or maybe colleges themselves, or maybe what economists sometimes call negative externalities or negative spillover effects. College graduates are not helping society like they are purported to do. Now, I say this as a college professor who has taught at a university. I was teaching college. Literally, I was teaching class the day John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. Now, that is 60-plus years ago. I was only a graduate student, to be sure, but I was teaching a class at a Big Ten university, and a fine university, University of Illinois, to be precise. And so I've been around the block, and I've been around higher ed for a long time. And I love it. I think it's a great, I think we do a lot of wonderful things. And I do think young people need, it's better to learn more than to be ignorant. Ignorance is not cool. Learning can help develop not only vocational opportunities, but make life better in many ways. But we've goofed. We've made mistakes. Mostly public.
Too much of a good thing.
Yeah. Too much of a good things, and also too much government, I think, is involved. I'm reading a biography of a famous conservative person of the 20th century, William F. Buckley.
Oh, the new one.
Yeah, the new book. I'm reading it. And in the midst of it, Buckley, as a young college student, 20, 21 years old, has got everyone going crazy at Yale with all of his statements he's making at how we're godless, we hate markets, we're too left-wing, and all this. And Buckley's saying this as the editor of the Yale Daily News. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, Buckley has the president of Yale University, who's about ready to retire, speak there. And the president of Yale, what did he warn about, either at that talk or one given a couple months later? A guy named Charles Seymour. He says, higher education is going to be in trouble because it's depending too much on the federal government. It's threatened by federal government subsidies, and that'll take away our independence and our integrity and the way we do things, and we will regret it. Now, that was said in January or February of 1952, 73 years ago, and it has certainly come true. And so everyone who's in the Ivy League are complaining, oh, they're cutting off subsidies and they're fining us and they're going to cut our government grants and so forth. Harvard and Columbia, are getting punished for the anti-Semitic behavior and so forth. And they're madder than all get out. Is the world coming to an end? The problem is they're complaining because the federal government is cutting them off. Well, if they had never had the federal government in the first place, if they had behaved like Hillsdale College,
yeah,
or Grove City College, these are colleges that don't take any money. They don't even let their students take any money from the federal government.
Well, the federal government doesn't let their students take out money.
You can look at it either way. There's virtually no federal involvement. I say virtually. I can't think of any federal involvement, and I've spoken several times at Hillsdale myself. That's part of the problem. So we have a series of problems. Well, I'll stop talking here.
Well, let me talk about something. The big bill that got passed through legislation, I'm told there's limits on federal students, student loans, and that they give universities a little bit of skin in the game now, which is if the students who have taken federal loans have been unable to pay back or have defaulted on those loans, then the federal government's just not going to lend money to students in those programs anymore.
I think the new bill, the big, beautiful bill, or whatever they call it, was a positive development. It didn't go to the extent some of us wanted on the skin in the game issue, which the pure thing would have been to say, well, if the kids don't pay their loans back, the colleges should, or pay at least part of it back. Because they're at least partially complicit in the students not making their payments because the kids...
There's nothing else the admissions officer's like, here, apply for these loans.
So the colleges should have some skin in the game. They didn't do a pure, quote, skin in the game thing, but they made a step in the right direction. One thing that's part of the bill, as I understand it, is that if the graduates of a college have incomes after they graduate that are below the average income of high school graduates, those colleges are going to lose federal funding. Mm-hmm. They're just going to be cut off. If you're going to college lowers your income compared with what high school would do, you don't deserve to get federal money. I don't think that's far enough, but it's a step in the right direction. I think the new bill, in short, made some positive moves in the right direction. They put some limits on graduate. Right now, a student can borrow $200,000-$300,000 to go to a law school at Harvard. And when they get done, they'll start the first job at $185,000 a year, $200,000 a year at a Wall Street law firm. Why should the federal government be promoting people going to Wall Street law firms making $200,000 a year jobs? Isn't the purpose of these programs to help people, of lower incomes get through college? Why don't we make loans to high school graduates who a talented high school graduate wants to open an auto body shop? I don't know anything about auto body shops, but wants to borrow $50,000 to open an auto body shop. We don't allow that. We don't do that. But if you want to borrow $50,000 to go to Harvard, that's all right. We'll, of course, lend you the money. So it's crazy.
Well, I want to talk about this shift in the Overton window, because my understanding of the federal loan game is that they only expanded. They didn't contract. In fact, during the Biden administration, the taxpayers are now just paying off particular people's student loans and without congressional approval, which is crazy to me. And we were part of a lawsuit challenging some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. My anger over the student loan program reached heights that I didn't think were possible. I always thought the program was inefficient, inappropriate. I didn't even see the reason for it. People were borrowing money for banks and their parents and other ways to go to college before we had a federal student loan program. College attendance was rising sharply through the 1950s and 60s and early 70s before we began these large student loan programs. So I didn't ever understand why we had them in the first place, but it's gotten way out of hand now. And we need to put a stop to it. And maybe what we need to do is find other ways for people to finance it. And on the Biden years, as you said, James, I mean, it was just, they were doing, I think, totally unconstitutional. They were making decrees, making laws. And some people would say that's happening under the Trump administration now. So I'm not a lawyer, and probably to some extent there has been executive overreach in both administrations. But certainly under Biden, it was shameful what was going on with it.
Yes. But now that has changed. I mean, there are limits on this. And yeah, as you said,
they're putting some limits on. You can't borrow as much as you wanted to. If you don't pay back your loan, there are consequences. You're all credit rating as an individual borrower. If you just simply, I'm going to ignore my student loans, nothing's going to happen, really. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to start having credit ratings going down for people, and they're going to find they're not able to borrow money to buy a house or a car. And that's good. That's good. That should happen. People should be responsible.
So how much of this change that has happened recently, again, like federal loans expanded, now they're being limited. How much of that is your doing?
Oh, I take zero credit. Well, you know, that's an interesting question, James. Mm-hmm. Not just with respect to me, but with respect to people generally. How much can they impact policy? How much can academics impact policy? Put it at a broader than just my personal thing. And obviously, academics influence policy a lot. Everyone who, Trump's top advisor, Biden's top advisor, most of them had prominent academic backgrounds. One or two of Trump's top advisors are friends of mine, former academics, Kevin Hassett, who was a prominent academic background, and then with a fellow think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, and whatnot. These are the class of people who are academically oriented dominate the Washington scene. And Washington is, in a way, run by academics. And they run it. They also contribute a good bit of the money, particularly for the Democratic Party, because most academics seem to be Democrats. And so universities are wards of the state. That's what they are. They are wards of the state. And that's too bad, I think. I think Harvard was a wonderful school when it wasn't a ward of the state. And, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Hillsdale's a wonderful college because it never was a wonderful ward of the state. And there are a few others. I keep talking about Hillsdale, or I never even attended Hillsdale College, but
my grandparents did.
Yeah, it's a good school.
Yeah. So my state government showers its the state's universities with taxpayer money and doesn't ask for anything in return. Not even for in-state tuition for state residents anymore. In fact, there are some places that offer out state students same in-state tuition, which might be a good thing, but I mostly met with shrugs when I point out that the state can ask them to do something for all of the money that gets handed out. What is it going to take to get legislators to care about their role with state universities?
Wow. You're asking a tough question.
Yeah.
Trying to get legislatures to act responsibly is a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
As one who has worked for legislators, and I think I've spoken at more than 25 state legislative bodies in the United States. In other words, I've all the way from Alaska to Florida. I can use that as an example. I've spoken in Juneau. I've spoken in Tallahassee. I've spoken in Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been around the block a little bit. And there is a problem in America that politicians respond to their immediate whatever provides job security for them in the short run. Fortunately, in state governments such as Michigan and in my state of Ohio, we have balanced budget amendments that enforce a modest amount of responsibility on state politicians. Not as much as we would like, perhaps, but they at least have to balance their budget. The federal level, we don't even have that.
Mm-hmm.
So at the federal level, a politician makes a decision. Well, if we spend $5 billion on this, I'll win votes and more than I'll lose votes, so I'll be ahead. So they always want to spend money. So there's money to be, there's votes to be won by spending money. There's votes to be lost by taxing people or cutting spending or doing something that would balance budgets to be fiscally responsible. So we are fiscally irresponsible at the federal level, and we're less so at the state level. Now, there are examples at the state level where there's mistakes, and there are borrowings for dubious projects of various kinds. I read the Mackinac literature, I must say, and I must say I've noticed a few transgressions in the Wolverine state that perhaps would be better. It would have been better if they didn't happen. I'm in Ohio, and it's the same problem. So, but we do need rules to constrain people from doing irresponsible things. Politicians act like alcoholics in a liquor store, or you don't let teenage boys go into girls' locker rooms because that. Bad things will happen. There are certain constraints we put on human behavior, and we ought to put those constraints on politicians more than we do. That's just a general statement. Sorry, maybe we're getting a little far afield here, James.
Well, so this is, again, I'm asking it because this is part of the thing that I struggle with, is that our state universities spend a lot of taxpayer money on, or sorry, our state legislators spend a lot of taxpayer money on these state universities and don't ask anything in return. This money just gets spent. And there's not really a good accounting for what we get in return.
Yep.
There's some things that I think society just generally wants from these state universities. Like, we would prefer it for some of the things that you're talking about. If students don't have to spend that much to get a good quality education and can do it in less time, these are things that I think state legislators probably want. They could use that chunk of state money to try to encourage them to do, or even for something else. So Michigan Tech is the rated by the Foundation for Individual Rights as the second best college for free speech in the country.
Great.
I think that's something that legislators would want emulated in other state universities. They can ask that of them, and they don't, in part because that means rocking the bench among powerful political actors like the people who run these state universities, and they're the biggest employers in whatever legislative districts they're in, so they've got someone to fight for them. But these are things that, like, I think legislators want, but they're just not asking for.
No, and because they get free tickets or cheap tickets to the University of Michigan football games or Michigan State, whatever, school you're related to, and they get pampered by the universities in inappropriate ways or dubious ways, but they're ignoring the important things. Do the students know anything about our constitutional principles, for example? I'll just use history as an example. Do they know the Bill of Rights? Are they familiar with basic documents? Have they ever read the Gettysburg Address? Or
I've sung the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah.
There's a version of it. There's a community choir here that we covered one of those.
Oh, really?
Which, by the way, easiest way to memorize a piece is by, you know, putting it to song.
Oh, that's what. There's only 271 words in the Gettysburg Address, by the way, the greatest speech ever given. The best speeches are often fairly short. Something us professors could learn a lesson, and politicians too. And I must say priests and pastors as well. They could learn a little lesson by shortening their message a bit.
Yeah. All right. So I guess you've written this book. There's actually a lot of what you're covering. Like, we've been a little dour about some things, but there has been progress. Again, we mentioned the federal student loans. You cover in the book a lot of administrators who are trying new things. You know, it's scattered here and there. It's not like big industry trends, but there are administrators doing entrepreneurial things in higher education. So where's this all headed?
Well, that's a good question. I think public policy is changing in a way that probably is for the good. For example, some of the things that the Trump administration have done have been a little heavy-handed, maybe even constitutionally dubious. You know, I'm not a legal expert. Cutting off research grants, cutting off scholarships or visas for foreign students abruptly. It is disruptive and so forth, but it does send a message that the public is not tolerating the way colleges are behaving. They don't tolerate anti-Semitic behavior. They don't tolerate crazy spending in some cases. Some campuses are like country clubs these days, building, you know, it used to be they built climbing walls, then they built lazy rivers, whatever a lazy river, sort of super swimming pools for the students. In Michigan there, that's probably less important than it would be in this southern state. But so where is it heading? I think as enrollments have declined for the last 15 years in the United States. There are fewer people going to college today than were 15 years ago. That the markets are working in a sort of inefficient way because they're so much government subsidy. Government subsidies prevent them from working efficiently, but they don't totally have an impact. They are having an impact. Markets are having an impact. And as that happens, more colleges are starting to fail. We've had most states in the union have one or two, the large states have one or two, at least liberal arts colleges have failed. Well, there's one in Adrian, Michigan, that failed the other day. I forgot the name.
It wasn't Adrian College, it was the other one.
It wasn't the other, it was a Catholic college in Adrian that failed. And as those schools start to fail more, colleges are going to have to say, we're in trouble. We've got to do something different. Maybe we need to ask our faculty to teach four courses a semester instead of three. Maybe the millions of new administrators, not millions, hundreds of new administrators we've hired over the last decade weren't really needed. What does, you know, most of them don't teach. They don't do research. They don't do what universities are supposed to be doing. So why do we have them? Well, we need some of them to, you know, issue transcripts and maintain the buildings and so forth. We do need some of them, but we don't need hordes of them. And maybe we'll start learning those lessons out of necessity. Necessity is the mother of invention, Plato allegedly said, and he actually never really quite said that, but it was close.
Yeah, and, Zeus and Creek.
Yeah. So I think we will see some improvements. And as you mentioned, we've had some legislative improvements in the last few days or weeks. And that, I think will have some positive effects. So I am not totally pessimistic about the future. And I think that's something to be pleased about.
The book again is Let Colleges Fail. Richard, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you, James. I enjoyed participating.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.